Now listen, we're going to move on to the regulations committee. You want that guy there?
That's why you just put it between the two.
That way you can grab it if you need to.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
No move.
Okay, moved by Bivens, second by Commissioner Brown. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All in favor? About that? Okay, hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Cook?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First item is just an FYI. You'll be hearing more about it in the upcoming meetings, November, January. Legislation enacted by the 80th Texas Legislature requires that TPWD regulate party votes on inland lakes and waterways. The bill requires such boats to be subject to annual inspection, requires the operator of a party boat to be licensed and complete a boat safety course, imposes limits on the number of passengers authorized on the boat at any time, requires party boat operators to maintain a minimum amount of liability insurance. The bill provides rulemaking authority to the commission to implement the provisions of the subchapter, including fees, and requires the commission to adopt such rules no later than January 1, 2008. So that means we're going to get it done in your next meeting.
Yeah.
And this is just sort of the pre-notice.
Right.
Okay. We are moving forward on that one and as quickly as we can. Second item, commissioners, our public dove hunting lease program, which we call the dove lease, that program will enjoy, I believe, another great season starting in September. For this season, our staff has put together 154 different units across the state that we have leased, totaling over 55,000 acres of land located in 50 different counties in all parts of the state. Many of the areas are within an hour's drive of a major metropolitan area. We believe that's part of the success of this program is getting those good sunflower fields, even if they're just 20 acres or 100 acre fields, accessible, where mom or dad can pick up the kid at the end of school and run out and make a couple hour dove hunt that afternoon and be back home for dinner.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking for that to be a good one. I note here they noted that this year we're proud to have our first lease area in Bexar County. So if it's in Bexar County, you know it's close to the major spot. It's a great program and it looks like we're headed to there. An interesting note, again, on our shrimp buyback program, which y'all have all followed this program for many years, you know about it. We do aerial counts of shrimp boats that are out in the bay active on opening day. Dr. McKinney and his staff have done this for years. Aerial counts of shrimp boats were conducted in good weather on August the 15th. A total of 180 boats were counted coastwide, one end of the other, which is the lowest count recorded since we began opening day surveys in 1994. The highest fall count was recorded in 1995 was 886 boats out shrimping. 886. This year, 180. Last year, we counted 213 active on the opening day. So I think you can see the result of combination of things, to be honest. The buyback program is absolutely having the intended effect. Also, farm-raised shrimp, as you know, is providing a large part of the shrimp that's sold in the market today. Some of those boats are not active, the ones that are licensed. But we are definitely on a good path there, and I think fisheries in the bays and estuaries are going to see a positive flush from that.
What's the target number?
Well, and I may have to get Doc to help me out here, but I believe when the program started that the idea was to get the number below 400 active shrimpers, and we're there. Now, there are several hundred shrimp boats out there that still are licensed every year, 700-800, Doc, in that range, and I guess if shrimp prices, fuel prices, all of those issues are driving this business. But, you know, we've seen a very clear trend over the last several years of the boats that are actually out shrimping, that are actually out catching shrimp, catching, bycatch, whatever it is they're catching, has declined dramatically over this period. Doc?
Just to clarify, so I'm Larry McCain, Director of Coastal Fisheries. Our goal is about 400 boats, that's what we're talking about, and our licenses now, we're almost reaching about half the available licenses that when the program started, we cut that down to about half. So we think within this biennium coming up, we'll reach our goals of hitting a sustainable shrimp fishery that doesn't impact that recreational fishery anymore that really has to and supports boats. So very excited about reaching it. It's taken us 10 years, but we're about to get there, and it's a big deal for us in the coastal agreement.
Well, we're not trying to eliminate the industry.
No, sir.
Absolutely not. We want an industry that's sustainable, right. Right, that works, and that's kind of where we're headed.
Right. Is there any point there at which the number of licenses might convert to an ITQ system?
That's our next step. Once we get the licenses down, numbers where they should be, the next step is, okay, how can we, and that's how we make these folks profitable and work, and put in new points in the system like that. We want to start in the next several years some pilots on that particular approach. I think that is the way to go.
Explain that approach.
Basically, once you reach a certain level in a different base system or something like that, you have a catch you think will allow an amount of shrimp in an area.
Right.
And you have a number of shrimpers, and basically you allocate that catch amongst those shrimpers and let the market take care of the system after that. We'd like to be in a position where basically we can turn our shrimpers loose and say, look, you sell what you can, best bait or food or whatever. You follow these rules, you make the best business decision you can, and go after it.
The problem we've had is you get licenses to catch the limited amount.
Oh, no.
ITQ is your control quality. Biologically, that's the amount that's allowed them to allocate. So it gives the property right to personal license. I mean, value creation to them.
Yeah. We just want to get out of the race to catch the last shrimp and get people in the situation where they can really compete.
It seems like we ought to be in a number where there's an incentive. They will actually create value in the licenses by doing that. We're close.
I think we're about to turn that corner and go there.
Yeah. Well, Ken, do we, from a regional standpoint, is that something that we would look at as we have the lower within the lottery? Would we look at possibly, depending on the region, having a different set of rules?
I think very likely. So even within Bay systems, how to make that makes the most sense.
Right.
Doc, as I recall, hearing you and Robin talk, shrimping has been good.
It has. Yeah, I mean, it's excellent right now. We've had some reports, for example, of some of the bay boats in this open day coming back with 1,000 pounds of 25, 26. That's perfect. So the shrimp are out there, and that's good for everyone. Of course, those shrimp will go offshore, and they're a fundamental, a basis for our recreational fishery. So it's good.
I mentioned that because of a couple of items. I think, yeah, you know, we're down from late 86 to 180, but we're seeing the shrimpers are seeing the benefit themselves. The shrimpers that are out there shrimping are catching bigger and more shrimp. And that's a lot of people in the boat. Has a lot of fresh water in the bay this year also.
But we're going to get a big boost from that down the road. There's never too much rain.
Okay, thank you, Doc.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, you may recall, Commissioners, that this past spring we held our first statewide alligator season.
That's right.
And there was quite a bit of dancing around among some folks about whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing. You know, they were required to get a tag after they harvested the gator, and have a license and all of that before they did, and some basic rules and criteria. And our guys are still looking at what happened. But what happened was they harvested 167 alligators. Sport hunters, recreation hunters, and I will tell you that of that 167, and I see my friend Jim Sutherland back here from Murphy Wildlife here, who has heads up that program for years, a lot of big alligators in somebody's pond, hanging around somebody's pond, or you know, wherever they hang out. But I think overall, I've had practically no negative comments. Again, the only negative comments, as you may recall, were from the folks in that little restricted area down there that sort of had a lock on the board. And again, we're not trying to put them out of business. We're not trying to hurt them in any manner. I don't think the harvest of 167 alligators is going to impact their business, and certainly not going to impact a resource that is now well established and well distributed throughout much of the state of Texas. Some of the biggest gators, and Jim may have happened out here, were taken down around Choke Canyon and in the Rio Grande Valley. Big, like 11 footers.
Unlikely places.
Well, thank you, sir.
That's where they are.
Thank you. Okay, committee item number two, statewide hunting and fishing proclamation rule amendments. Mike Berger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm Mike Berger, Wildlife Director, and have a little matter this morning of, I think, will increase safety of some hunting opportunities and an increase in efficiency in those opportunities. House Bill 308, which was enacted in this past legislature, amended our code to authorize the use of laser sighting devices by hunters who are legally blind under the standards of the government code. Made other provisions that the hunter be accompanied by another licensed hunter age 13, licensed hunter at least age 13 or older who is not legally blind, and we're required to adopt rules to prescribe proof of legal blindness, and these rules were published for public comment in the July 6th issue of the Texas Register. We have received so far 10 comments on these rules, 7 were in favor, and 3 were in opposition. One opposed that he didn't believe blind people should hunt, and the other one thought that 13 was a little young to accompany a blind hunter. And of course, these people may not necessarily be completely blind, but they are blind, but legally blind by the standards of the government code. And this laser sighting device will help them, help those who are accompanying them and assisting them in placing a safe and humane shot on our wildlife. So,
are these like normal laser sights, or are they some modification of the standard?
I think these are laser sights that will in some way be attached to the rifle and sighted in, much like laser sights that are attached to handguns, and will allow. I think what happens now is the accompanying hunter kind of stands behind the guy and tries to look through the scope and have him adjust, where now with this projected laser beam out there, to be able to more accurately aim the rifle.
Right. Right. That's the standard. People use it at night, like to shoot hog.
Right.
In my previous life, I had some legal blind hunters, and one gentleman who truly loved to hunt. He had an apparatus hooked up where it basically had a double scope. And whoever was with him was pretty much, you know, helping him get on target.
Yeah.
He could sometimes, depending on light, he could see the image out there. But it's one of those things that certainly we got a great resource here to utilize, and I think the equipment is available today that makes it more effective and easier to handle. Like Chris, this is a question about the 13. I'm not a bit worried about that. That dot gets on the right spot.
And also, 13-year-olds completed our hunter safety program. So.
And these, even the blind hunters are required to meet our hunter safety requirements. So.
Increased opportunity.
Exactly.
Yes.
So.
Just
any other discussion? Okay. Other discussion? I'll place this item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you. All right. Committee item 3, 2007-2008 Migratory Bird Proclamation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. Today, I will brief you on the proposed migratory bird regulations for 2007-2008 waterfowl season. habitat conditions where ducks and geese breed were in pretty good shape this year, particularly for waterfowl, but for ducks. And we look forward to an expanded fall flight over last year. Pond counts, which is one of the measures that's taken each year in the Prairie Pajot country, increased again this year. The red line is the long-term average, and as you can see, pond counts are well above that long-term average. This is the breeding population survey of the 10 most popular ducks, and that red line is again the long-term trend, and the breeding population is for the second year back up above that long-term average. We got a few changes to propose this year. One is adding geese to the youth hunting bag, which is the first time we've been able to add geese to that youth hunt. We're shifting some days in the High Plain Mallard Management Unit from the 16-day field season. The High Plain Mallard Management Unit will have a shorter season, and we'll move those extra days in the regular duck season. And we've increased the bag, been able to increase the bag, counted the geese by one in the west goose zone. And then the conservation, the light goose conservation order will close a little later this year. For ducks, mergansers, and coots, the youth hunt in the High Plain Mallard Management Unit are shown as October 13 and 14. The regular waterfowl season is shown as the weekend of the 20th and 21st. Reopens again on the 26th and runs to the last Sunday in January. The High Plain Mallard Management Unit, the red area, gets expanded numbers of days over the rest of the state because it is up and down our flyway. The west side is a lightly hunted region, so many years ago we were able to gain 23 extra hunting days on top of the regular season length for the High Plain Mallard Management Unit. For the north and south goose duck zones, they're basically the same as last year with the calendar shift. They run concurrently with each other. We have again for the 10th consecutive year the liberal duck package, which is unprecedented. And so we operate the east side of the state, although in two zones the same days are proposed. If we ever go back to a shorter duck season, that's when the zones really become important to us in maximizing our opportunity as ducks migrate north and south. The bag limit is again similar to last year. I would point out to the commissioners that we are entering the second year of what we call our Hunter's Choice bag, which is an aggregate bag where hunters can take one of any of the species, including mallard hens, pintail, canvasback, or what we call dusky ducks, which would be our mottled duck, black duck, or the Mexican duck that occurs in parts of West Texas. For the east goose zone, all the goose seasons open on the same date, November the 3rd. We are proposing again, as we have done in the past, to have a 2 white front bag limit. And when we ask for the feds for a 2 white front bag limit, that requires us to have only a 72-day season for white fronts where we have longer seasons for the other species. So that season closes on January the 13th instead of January the 27th. For the western goose zone, we have a light goose season and dark goose season opening concurrently and running concurrently. We have achieved one Canada goose increase in the bag limit for the west goose zone, so that's a little plus for our hunters out there. The light goose conservation order will open immediately after all the other waterfowl season closes. So in the west goose zone, it opens on the 6th of February and runs through the 30th of March. And in the east, it opens on the 28th of January and runs through the 30th of March. Our sandhill crane season is broken out by 3 zones, the A, B, and C. And those zone seasons are a little bit different based on the migration of hooping cranes. Zone B and C open and closed a little differently based on that, and as shown in this slide. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Yep. Martin, do you have any numbers on the late season light goose take?
We do, and I don't have them on top of my head, but I certainly provide those.
I mean, I guess where I'm going at is, how effective is that?
We saw some data during the waterfowl council meetings this year that indicated that the light goose numbers are beginning to come down a little bit, and we have a real opportunity. I'm told we were discussing this back in July's council meeting. We have a real opportunity to make a more significant impact on that light goose harvest this year because it was a poor hatch. And the hunters generally take the dumbest of the lot, and that's not the 20-year-old light goose that's made this trek multiple times. It's that first time flyer that doesn't know some of the tricks of the trade. But so it was a poor hatch. It was late springs in the Arctic breeding areas, and so we will. On the bad side, we will be facing the smartest of them, but on the good side, we think we can bring that number down a little bit. The problem still exists. The problem will continue to exist for a long time.
And so I can't remember if it was, I think it was when I was on the minor sports objects, when you showed the slides of the incredible devastation of the Canada from the breeding ground. And how has that improved or changed?
Well, that devastation on the west shore of Hudson Bay still exists. There's still lower numbers of breeding geese in that area and lower numbers of other breeding birds because of the impact of the goose population on that fragile habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that damage has expanded to other areas in the Arctic where light geese have expanded breeding colonies. So, you know, it's still our challenge to bring that population down. But and in that country, just like our desert country, recovery is a long, long time in coming. A lot of that coastal environment gets salty real when you remove the vegetation and the ground dries out, it turns to a salt flat, and you don't grow much on salt flat.
Vernon, would you share with all the commission the conversation that you and I and some of the ducks and people have been having regarding the pintail and the scout?
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to.
Because I think this is very important for all of us.
Of the 10 species of ducks that we monitor population on, pintail and scout are the ones that we kind of monitor the closest and seem to have the most problem in responding to habitat. So we're looking at those real close. We met with the Service Regulations Committee in early August. We concluded that we would have a stalk harvest. It included two birds in a bag again this year. All four flyways are required to come back to the service next year with a harvest management plan for each flyway and look at the scalp issue. These are, and pintail the same thing. Pintail numbers are about what they were last year, and pintail has been a bird that has been hurting ever since the prairie dried up in the 80s and have not responded as well as others. Pintail are also very hard to count. And so when you look at the breeding population on pintail, it certainly represents a very minimum number of birds in the breeding population. Because we have chosen this the Central Flyway chose this hunter choice approach to dealing with low stocks of birds and putting an aggregate bag together where you can only take one, we are protecting pintails in the Central Flyway. The pintail allowable in the other three flyways is one bird per day. So we're doing our best to protect pintails, and we think we're doing an adequate job service wouldn't be allowing us what they allow us if they were very concerned.
Any other questions or discussion? Commissioner Montgomery.
For 6 years you give this presentation, I always admire your knowledge and facility. And I've had a question every time I hear it. I'm going to ask, how many people are you 15 food today?
probably a few in South Louisiana. So they have a recipe. I had an uncle that killed about 20 of them one time many, many years ago when it was 25. So I do have that.
Any other questions? Mr. Parker.
I'll put this in public record. There are people from Southwest Louisiana that come to Lake Sam Rayburn at Livingston Lake and do nothing but shoot coots. And the only harvested part of that bird is the liver and the gizzard.
Well, they make a little cooler.
Well, I know that. You know what they eat.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, any other discussion?
You watch for the queen.
You watch, right?
All right, I will no further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on a Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Thank you for the opportunity. I just want to comment that I've known Bob Cook for over 30 years. We go back to when we were both real biologists in this business.
That was a long time ago.
And I wouldn't be here in Texas if it weren't for Bob Cook. And I've been here for 15 years, and I've always admired Bob's savvy and insight in all matters related to wildlife, and I will miss him.
We all will.
Good.
Any other business?
Okay,
this committee has completed its business. We'll move on to the Conservation Committee.